Jai, Gangamai Jamuna Devi Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda Ki Jai, Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada. Namo Om Vishnu Daya Swastami Lashmi Divakti Nandi Swami. Namaste Saraswati Devi Devan Pachani Nisarasi Samyama Kasasthi. Rai Shri Shri Adikakana. Mandeham Sri Guru Sri Yutala Padakamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavam Sri Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahaganaya Vilakam Vitam Samsajiva. Sadhvaitam Sadhvaditam Padijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Vyam Shri Radha Krishna Param Jaya Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitam Shri Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 29, Talks Between Narada and King Puchinavadi. Text 41. Eta rupa juto nityam. Jiva loka swabhava jai.
Jiva loka swabhava jai.
Nakaroti harer nunam. Katam rita nidhauratim.
Etai
rupa juto nityam. Jiva loka swabhava jai. Nakaroti harer nunam. Katam rita nidhauratim. Etai, by these, upadrutaha, disturbed, nityam, always, jivalokaha, the conditioned soul in the material world, swabhava chai, natural, nakaroti, does not do, harehe, of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Nunam, certainly. Kata, of the words. Amrita, of nectar. Nidau, in the ocean. Ratim, attachment. So, in the previous verse, Narada Muni was explaining how the great devotees are very much enjoying the happiness of talks about Krishna. We have, in the previous verse, piyusha, means something you drink.
of nectar. And here again, we're using the word nectar, amrita. Mrita means death, amrita means without death, or nectar. Ninau, the ocean, rati, to be attached. So, attachment to the, oh, what nectar? What ocean of nectar? Hare, the ocean of nectar of Hari. But we find that some people, Ajiva Lokaha, Swabhava Jai, Swabhava, his own nature, so being affected by his own material nature, are not swimming in this ocean, not attached to the ocean, not interested in the ocean. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Because the conditioned soul is always disturbed by the bodily necessities, such as hunger and thirst, he has very little time to cultivate attachment to hearing the nectarian words of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So here Prabhupada's speaking about cultivating attachment, not even already having such attachment, but even wanting to develop such attachment. And Prabhupada is translating the swabhava jaya, what's natural, as always being disturbed by hunger and thirst. In other words, the swa here is of the body, not of the soul. It's interesting when Srila Prabhupada focuses on this purport. Unless one is associated with devotees, he cannot cultivate Krishna consciousness. Nirjana bhajana, what does nirjana mean literally?
Without people.
Without people. Nirjana bhajana, cultivating Krishna consciousness in a solitary place, is not possible for the neophyte, for he will be disturbed by the bodily necessities, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. Being so disturbed, one cannot cultivate Krishna consciousness. We therefore see that devotees known as sahajiya, who make everything very easy, do not associate with advanced devotees. Such persons, in the name of devotional activities, are addicted to all kinds of sinful acts, illicit sex, intoxication, gambling, and meat eating. There are many so-called devotees passing themselves off as devotees while engaging in these sinful activities. In other words, one who is influenced by sinful activities cannot be accepted as a person in Krishna consciousness. A person addicted to sinful life cannot develop Krishna consciousness, as indicated in this verse. Utaru padruta vicha jiva loka svabhava vajaya na karoti haririna katham dutam nidavati. Because the conditioned soul is always disturbed by the bodily necessities such as hunger and thirst, he has very little time to cultivate attachment to hearing the nectarian words of the Supreme Personality of God. It's interesting, and here normally he says, not karoti. Karoti is action, they don't do. And Prabhupada translates it, they don't have any time. And we see this in general. I mean, even among devotees, one of the main questions that people ask is, how can I get more time for my sadhana? How can I get more time for my Krishna consciousness? How can I find some, they usually use the word balance, between the activities I have to do, svabhava chai, the activities I have to do for this material body. Prabhupada says here, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. These are the needs of the body, or in the verse he says, hunger and thirst. So the body has certain needs. Prabhupada says if you don't get enough sleep, you don't have any intelligence. You ever found that? That if you're very, very tired, you make foolish decisions. You know, the majority of sleep is for the mind. You know? The body needs about 1.5 to 2 hours of sleep, healthy body. And the rest of sleep is for the mind. That's why we have dreams, for the mind to sort everything out. Just like, you know, if you have a big desk and you never straighten anything out or put anything away, it's very hard to function. You just get, have you ever seen people who have, maybe some of you, you have desks like this, the instead of the filing system, you have the piling system. You know? It's very hard to get anything done. So at least periodically, you have to. If you don't go through it periodically, you won't even have a desk anymore. So periodically, you have to sort things out. So the mind also does that. We're receiving so many impressions during the day, and then at night, the mind is filing and making connections and understanding And the body is also going through a restoration process. Again, just like we clean the room, you have to sometimes clean your room. So the body also has to clean out all of the organs, right? The body temperature goes down, the metabolism, everything slows down, and the body is working on restoration. So that's a need of the body. The body has to sleep in the same way the body has to eat. First thing we do when we come out of the womb after we cry is we eat. And if you think about it, so much of our lives are centered around eating. So much of our lives. You see the work that people do. People are working 8 hours a day, driving to and from work, primarily for eating and for shelter during sleeping. Because when you're sleeping, you can't protect yourself from bugs and thieves and rain. You can sleep with an umbrella over you. You have to have some kind of shelter. So people are working very hard to keep up their shelter and to eat. In a natural society, people would be literally growing the food during the day. They'd be out there growing the grains, growing the vegetables, milking the cows. In a modern society, we go to some place of work and we get money and we pay someone else to grow the food, usually with a machine. But, you know, I've thought about this. Why is Krishna arranged that we have to do things like eat and sleep? I mean, the fact that we have to eat and sleep and the fact that we're so helpless during sleep forces us to work hard. We have to, in order to keep the body alive, and we think the body is me, and therefore I have to keep it alive, in order to enjoy all the things I want to enjoy, we're forced to work. As Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, you can't maintain your physical body without work. It's impossible to keep the body alive and do nothing. It just won't work. You have to be very active. And then what to speak of mating and defending? So a lot of work has to go into just taking care of a shelter, a place for sleeping, and to get food for the body, and for mating also, which Prabhupada calls here a bodily necessity. One cannot give that up artificially. Actually, Prabhupada says if you try to give it up artificially, you'll become sick. So for that, one has to go through so much trouble. In order for mating, you have to have attractive clothing, and then you have to have a nice place to sleep, not just a cave, right? You have to have more money, and you have to spend so much time and energy first attracting, in modern society where there's not arranged marriages, you have to spend a lot of time and energy attracting a member of the opposite sex or finding a suitable member and going through many of them, like you might try to pick out a good car. You know, you have to investigate this one and that one, the other one. And then so much energy maintaining the relationship. You can't just say, okay, now I have my husband, now I have my wife, now it's over. Now automatically everything's going to be nuts. You have to put so much energy into maintaining the relationship, so much time. I was just with a couple in Hungary, a manager, and he was saying how he wanted to do more preaching and less administrative work. So I was sitting with him and his wife in the car, and I said, well, we'd like to do like 40% administrative, 60% preaching. And his wife said, what about time for the wife? So, you know, you have to spend some... I think she wanted to throw me out of the car. So you have to spend some time, right, maintaining the relationships, some time, some energy, some thought, and then mating means children, and then you have to spend time taking care of the children and having relationships with the children. Like Prabhupada said about Bhaktivinoda, he said he must have been a first-class father to have such good children. Even though he was a magistrate, even though he was writing 100 books, he still took such good care of the children. And then defending... we'd be surprised how much time and energy we put into defending. So, of course, defending is part of the sleeping, where you have to have some sort of enclosure, or at least some sort of roof. In this climate, you have to have some source of heat. And then what to speak of psychologically defending ourselves. So we're constantly having to try to defend ourselves against other living entities, you know, not just bugs and dogs, but mostly people. And... bugs, dogs, people, and the weather. So then we have no time. And not only do we have no time, we have no energy. We have very little, the materialistic persons, they have very, very little energy to do anything spiritual. And they're thinking, but I have to. The Prabhupada says necessity. Necessity means something you have to do. That if you don't do, there's some terrible consequence. Want to, if it's something I just want to do, that means that whether I do it or not, there's no consequence. But if I say it's a need, then if I don't fulfill a need, there's some very disturbing consequence. So people are thinking, I must, I must, I must. And they have no idea that I'm not this body. I really don't need to put so much energy into eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. Some, obviously. As long as you have the body, there's some. I mean, even the Goswamis were sleeping an hour and a half a day. You could see they were just sleeping for the body and not for the mind. Interesting. And then something. They were taking a little buttermilk. Of course, there's some great devotees who don't do any eating or sleeping. There was that, what was his name, of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's time? Vamsidas Babaji was his name, I think. And he didn't eat or sleep at all. He didn't eat, sleep, bathe, use the toilet, nothing. You know, he had no bodily necessities. And even some mystic yogis can do that. They can just live on the prana from the sunlight and not even drink any water for many, 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 many years and go without sleeping. And there's even some yogis today who claim to be able to do this, and sometimes there are scientific experiments that show that, in fact, they're not eating or drinking or sleeping, or to speak of mating or defending. Of course, defending, in one sense, is the strongest. This fear, being overwhelmed with fear, always fear of feeling vulnerable. But if one wants to get into this ocean of nectar, because if we think about it, you know, we're just maintaining the body. But the body is an abode of death. It's really constantly dying. That's what old age is. Old age is, you know, your body's breaking down and wearing down and dying. And all the cells of the body are constantly dying. And it's an abode of decay. You know, if we really think about all the elements of the body, it's really a nasty thing. The body is the manifestation of it's a gross manifestation of our material desires. We really have no need for a body. The soul doesn't need a body whatsoever. But when we have material desires, we get a proper vehicle to fulfill those desires. The vehicle matches our desires. It's the form of our desires. And maintaining the body is really just maintaining those desires. So a person who's a little intelligent understands, you know, really, maintaining this body is not terribly important. The only reason that we care about maintaining the body at all is that the body is also a vehicle for realizing Krishna. That the only way to develop spiritual desires is, as Prabhupada said, the best use of a bad organ. And once you have a body higher than the animals, once you have a human body, even if it's not the best human body, even if it has so many difficulties, still it's a vehicle by which you can understand Krishna. It allows enough uncovering over the soul. It's enough translucency. The animal body provides an opaque covering over the soul. Demigod bodies provide a transparent covering over the soul. And the human body provides like a translucent covering over the soul. Depending on the modes of nature, what is the extent of the covering. So human body is enough. Therefore we maintain this body because it's a good vehicle. Just exactly like if you want to drive, some devotees drove to Brussels today to get a visa for India. So you want to take care of the car. That means the car has to have some petrol, the car has to have some oil, it has to have the fluid in the windshield washer. You want to wash the car, right? You want to maintain the car. Why? So you can get your visa for India. So we want to maintain the body so we can get our visa for Golok Vrindavan. That's the only reason to maintain. Really. And then, of course, the devotee sees that even though this body is the gross manifestation of my material desires, it's a symptom of my enviousness of Krishna. It's what envy of Krishna looks like and smells like. That's what envy of Krishna is. Still, it's made up of material elements that all belong to Krishna. Because even if you hate Krishna, you can only express your hatred of Krishna through Krishna's energy. You can't even independently hate Krishna. Just imagine. He has to supply you the ingredients like the demons, you know, Shishupal, Dantavakra, Pandraka, Hiranyaksha. They're saying so many nasty things to Krishna.
What's their power of speaking?
That's Krishna. What are the elements that make up their tongue and their brain? That's Krishna. What's their ability? That's Krishna. What's their intelligence to compose criticisms of Krishna? That's also Krishna. So the devotee recognizes that even though originally I got this body in order to express envy of Krishna, that was why I got it, still, this body is Krishna's. It's Krishna's energy. And now that I'm deciding that maybe envy of Krishna is not such a good idea, I can still use this body to glorify Krishna. And I can take care of my body as devotional service. Prabhupada says that when the devotee sees his body belongs to Krishna, then taking care of the body is also devotional service. Of course, that shouldn't be our only devotional service. So what service are you doing for Krishna? Well, I have some of Krishna's property and I spend 5 hours a day bathing it and decorating it. You know, that's. And if some devotees spend all their time just washing the vehicles, you really wonder. But our primary time should be on meditating on Krishna. And meditating on Krishna is so nice. Kitamrita nirortim. It's an ocean of amrita. Right now, we're swimming in a little pond of blood and bones and etc. But talks about Krishna are an ocean of amrita, eternality. Just listening this morning, Prabhupada was speaking about how we're conditioned. And he gave the example that we can only see under certain conditions. We can only see if there's light. Have you ever been in a very dark place? Like really, really, really dark? My husband once took me to see the copper mines in Michigan. You go underground, and when they turn out the light, I mean, it is dark. You can't, as they say, you can't see your hand in front of your face. So we can only see under certain conditions. And even when there's light, I can't see everything. I can't see all of the rays of the sunlight. You know, we probably can't even measure all of them. We can only hear under certain conditions. And Prabhupada was saying, we originally have our spiritual senses, which are not conditioned. I was really thinking about that. So our spiritual body means we can hear, Prabhupada's saying, we can see, we can taste, we can smell, without any conditions. Wouldn't that be nice? And Prabhupada said we should become captivated by this information. He was also saying in another really nice lecture, Prabhupada was talking about the 26 qualities of a devotee, and he starts off by saying, these are all our natural qualities. We're a little part of God, and therefore we have the qualities, almost all the qualities of God, in a minute degree. We're full of good qualities. We're full of good qualities with unconditioned senses. So we should be interested to go back to our real nature. And therefore, we should put the bulk of our energy into that. Tasting real nectar, deathlessness, rather than putting the bulk of our energy into just maintaining the body. Thinking, why do we do that? Because we think the body is my source of happiness. The body is my source of life. The body is my source of pleasure. Although, by any logic, one can see that that's not the case. Of course, to be willing to do that requires something that appears from a materialistic point of view to be austerity. If one says, all right, I'm going to put the majority of my energy into diving into this nectar ocean so I can become self-realized, so I can realize, wow, I've got all the qualities of God. Wouldn't that be nice to realize that? I mean, we all like to think that we're good people. Wouldn't it be nice to actually realize that we're good? Actually be kind and poetic and merciful. I was talking a lot about how devotees are kind. He said something, and it was a little off topic, but he said something really interesting. He was saying how that many countries in the world, they're throwing grains into the ocean or paying farmers not to produce grains
when other people are starving. He said a devotee would never do that. A devotee is kind. A devotee would use the land to produce grains and feed the poor people of the world. And that was very interesting, because we, Prabhupada often talks about not doing mundane welfare work. But I thought, if you have a devotee kshatriya, and there are devotee kshatriyas, I was just talking to one a couple days ago, that's the kind of thing they would do. They would make sure everyone in the world got something to eat. That would be how they manifest their devotion. Anyway, so we have all these good qualities. And we have unconditioned senses. Unconditioned senses would mean you can see everything without any restriction all the time. You can hear everything without any restriction all the time. Almost unimaginable. Right? I mean, we're thinking that these eyes enable me to see. Really, what these eyes are doing is restricting my seeing. They're putting coverings over my spiritual eyes. But in order to do that, you know, we only have so much energy. We have to pull some of our energy away from our material necessities, realizing that I'm not the body. Therefore, it's not I needing all those things. It's the body. Let me take that to the minimum for good health and the minimum required for service. And let me pour my energy into my necessities. I mean, we give these examples all the time, right? These are all old. You know, yeah, I've heard this a million times. You know, the bird in the cage? Remember that one? The driver in the car. But just imagine. I mean, I don't have to imagine. It happens to me sometimes. Somebody picks me up from the airport. You know, and in the airports nowadays, if you don't travel, this won't make any sense to you, but you can't have any water. So like right before I got on the plane, the devotees had given, it was Bhaktivinoda's appearance day, so we drove fast in the car, and the devotees gave me these sandwiches that were really, 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 really salty. I said, I'm going to get thirsty, oh my God. They said, well, here's water. I said, no, you don't understand. I can't take water on the plane. You can't. Said, you guys don't travel. So they won't let you take water through security. And then it's a whole, you know, sometimes I wonder if the terrorists run the water selling things on the other side of security. And they're selling the water for 5 times as much as you buy it outside. So, you know, you don't want to buy the water there. And then on the plane, they're selling like a little bottle of water for €5. And if you say, can I please have some free water? No, I'm sorry, we don't give any free water. So when you get off the plane, and a plane makes you thirsty also. It's a very dry, I think it's 10% of the moisture that you find in a desert is what you find in a plane. So you're so thirsty, you know, and then you get in the car, and the driver stops to get petrol, but they don't have any water for you. It happens to me a lot. Okay, we're going to make sure we put petrol in the car and say, do you have any water? Oh, no. How long of a drive is into the temple?
Oh, 6 hours, you know.
Can we get so bad? So this is what we're doing. You know, we're putting petrol in the car, and we're not giving ourselves water. And then we wonder, why am I not happy? You know, why don't I have any happiness in the material world? Of course, there is a class of people, as Prabhupada talks about here, the sahajiyas, who try to make everything very easy. And they say, you know, you can just be on the bodily platform. You can be spiritual on the bodily platform. And there's a lot of people like this in the world, by the way. I think Prabhupada talks specifically about, you know, the sahajiyas as in a group in India, basically, who say, yes, I love Krishna, dancing with Krishna. But they don't do anything to pull themselves away from meditation on the body. In fact, they do sinful activities, not just normal bodily activities, but they do sinful activities in the name, Prabhupada says here, in the name of spirituality. Okay, well, we're all part of Krishna, so I'm Krishna, so let's rasa dance together. And this is just a disturbance, as Rupa Goswami says, if you do something without reference to the scriptures. But you find this all over the world. I mean, you find in Christianity people who just, I love Jesus. And they don't do any tapasya for Jesus. It's all over. It's among the Hindus, the Christians, the Muslims, the Jews, the Buddhists. This is not simply a problem of people who worship Krishna. This is a general problem. That, okay, I want spiritual life, but I still want to remain attached to the bodily concept of life. Now, you can't do that. Again, this body is a symptom of our envy and hatred towards Krishna. If that's our whole meditation, you can't also love Krishna. You just can't. It's not possible. And people intuitively know this. If someone says, I'm a religious person, there was one man in America who wrote these books about morality. And he made millions and millions of dollars writing these books about morality, books for adults, books for children, on moral values. And it turned out that he was a gambler. And people they rejected him. They rejected him. They said, if you're a gambler, how can you preach about morality? That's not even religion. But to speak of religion, if someone claims, yes, I'm a religious person, and they're having illicit sex, or taking intoxication, gambling, meeting, and people understand this is not, it's not, it can't be genuine. So if we want to dive in the real ocean of nectar, then there should be some evidence for that. But we should demonstrate that in some way. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada had all of us at initiation take these vows: no intoxication, no meat eating, no illicit sex, no gambling. At least that. To give up the attachment to, because these are all symptoms of wanting to envy Krishna, of wanting to try to enjoy the world separately from Krishna. They're all symptoms of exploitation. So how can I develop love if I'm not willing to give up my symptoms of exploitation? And this, again, it appears to the world as tapasya, but any system of religion without some tapasya is cheap. I mean, you can't even get anything material without some tapasya. It's not possible. You can't even eat, as we were saying, you can't even eat, sleep, mate, and defend without some tapasya. So what to speak of if we want to realize our eternal nature? And of course, once you realize some Krishna consciousness, you naturally become disinterested in the material world. So it shouldn't be just a forced thing. It shouldn't be just artificial austerity. Oh, I really want to just... It should be because I'm getting so much pleasure in my Krishna consciousness. And if we're finding the basic austerities of Krishna consciousness difficult, then we should increase our drinking of this nectar. It's interesting how it's often described as nectar, something liquid. In the previous verse also, pibanti, piyusha, to drink. And Prabhupada was quoting in the previous purport, pibanti ritkarna rasayana kata rasayana, is an Ayurvedic tonic that gives life. Or what Jiva Goswami says is the summary verse of the Bhagavatam is also this drinking idea. Pimantiye Bhagavata Atmana Sadam Katamritam Shravanapateshu Samritam. So in these, and also related to this idea of the association of devotees, which Prabhupada talks about. Bhagavat Satam, who's very dear to the devotees, that one takes these topics of Krishna, pibanti, and one drinks them, and they are like katamritam, they're full of nectar, shravanapadeshu samritam, they fill your ears. And then punanti te vishaya vidu sita swayam, one gives up this vishaya, this sense gratification, as very insignificant. Why? Vrajanti tach charana charo bhantikam. One starts getting Krishna's lotus feet, which is so nice. I mean, when we start experiencing our real self, which is full of kindness and beauty and effulgence and youth, and why would we want to put our energy into maintaining the false self? Why? When we're tasting our real relationship with Krishna, why would we want to put energy into trying to enjoy dead matter that doesn't reciprocate with us? So if we want to become Krishna conscious, then we need to do some initial austerity as an offering of love, willingly, happily, And we can measure our advancement in Krishna consciousness by how much we naturally do what to a materialistic person looks like austerity. How much we do that naturally, how much it's an expression of our happiness. Not how much one can become austere mechanically. That's not worth anything. It's just really not. Krishna says, not through austerity. So austerity both as a means to develop love and as a way then of expressing love and a way of understanding how we're advancing. And if we can't do that, then we must not be drinking that nectar. If I'm finding that I'm more attached to the world, that I'm more worried about the body, that I'm more worried about the world, what will happen when I get old? Who's going to take care of me? What about this thing? What about that thing? This might happen in the future. And what about this? And what about that? How can I take care of that? How can I take care of it? Then we can understand I must not be drinking this nectar enough. Not just officially drinking the nectar, not just, okay, I've done my thing. Okay, now put in my tongue for Krishna. But relishing, filling the ears, going from the ears to the heart. So that is what we should be doing. And we're so fortunate that even our so-called material activities, as explained in Bhagavad Gita 4.24, when we offer them to Krishna, they also become saturated with devotional service. So there then becomes no question of balancing our material and spiritual activities. Everything becomes good. And then, as Prabhupada says, one can drink nectar at every step. So I'm 2 minutes over. Questions, comments, or do I not have time? Do I have time? Can I take questions? Any questions, comments, corrections? Yes. So you said Krishna says we can't maintain our body without work. Does that mean any kind of physical exercise? No. It's not that the way you maintain your body is just by jumping up and down. The work is given. Krishna explains in the 18th chapter, anyone can become perfect by doing their work. And then he explains what? What does Krishna explain? The four what? The four varnas. So the work you do to maintain your body should be according to the nature of your body, not according to the nature of someone else's body, according to the nature of your body, without envy of somebody else's body or hatred of your body, just whatever nature you have, do some work. That work should be done then according to the Shastra. So you take your nature. How does the Shastra explain that I use this nature in work? And should be honest. No cheating. You do work according to your nature, the dictation of the Shastra, and whatever comes, you're happy with it. Whatever comes, doesn't come. If a lot comes more than what you need, then you engage that in charity. If what comes is so-called less than what you need, you also accept that as Krishna's will. And even then, Kulavitcha Sridhar engaged 50% in worship of the Ganga, although he was getting apparently less than what he needed. Now, whatever one gets, he's satisfied with that. Engage in charity. If you get a lot, you can engage a lot in charity. And offer it to Krishna. Is that right? Obviously, yes, you should also get some exercise. Yes?
So how to get like this nectar, arasanami, and so on.
How to get it?
Yeah.
Right here.
Kind of tapasya is sometimes, like, to do tapasya, oh, this is impossible, I'm so conditioned.
I'm doing a little tapasya.
Can I get nectar first?
Well, you know, that's modern society. Modern society, people live with credit cards. Let me get the nectar first, and then I'll do the tapasya. What's happening to the society? What does that do to the society?
bankrupts the society.
So give me the nectar first, then I'll pay for it. It's why people don't get married anymore. Well, let's have sex first, then we'll decide if we want to. That's the whole mentality in a lot of society. And hopefully I won't have to pay for it. I know people, even devotees, who calculate and say, okay, I'm going to use these credit cards and I'll max out this one and I'll max out this one and I'll max out this one and I'll buy something from my spiritual master so it's all transcendental. Yeah. And then I'll declare bankruptcy. You mean? Hare Krishna. Anyway, Krishna is so kind, especially in his mood of Chaitanya, that he does give some nectar first. Just like sometimes you go in a supermarket. What do you call it here? The hypermarket? Is that a supermarket? Okay, that's good. Hypermarket. I always think of hypermarket. You go in the supermarket and sometimes there's people giving out a little taste of something. You ever seen those people? They have like little chunks of cheese or something and toothpicks. And they're giving. So we do that. We give a little sample first. So Krishna gives a little sample. Even without any austerity. But then if you want to get the whole chunk of cheese, you've got to pay for it. So, yeah, of course, a little simple. Yes.
But we see the fact that most of the Brahmins are coming from Brahminic families that they are brought
yes.
up.
Certainly. Because your janma is determined by your guna and karma of your previous life. So, certainly.
So why isn't Krishna saying guna karma janma?
Because it's not necessary. If you say guna karma, then it's understood that that's also affecting janma. And you don't want to just use janma. That's dangerous because birth can be had for many reasons. You know, everyone who takes birth in Brussels has some sort of collective karma. There's something in common. They're all experiencing the same weather. They're all experiencing the same government. But they also each have their individual karma. So people who take birth in a Brahmin family may have something in common. Still they have their individual destiny. And then how one is dealt with in this life is also significant. Who one associates with whom one associates in this life is also significant. So I mean even Prabhupada would say this very frequently, even in our modern Western society, if you say, oh, that person's a lawyer, what you mean is they have their law degree and they're practicing law. If they don't have both their legal degree and their practicing law, you don't call them a lawyer. Well, you call them a retired lawyer if they used to practice law. But you would never call somebody a lawyer just because their parents are lawyers. Now, it's likely that if your parents are lawyers and your grandparents and your great-grandparents and your great-great-grandparents, it's likely that you'll become a lawyer, but not necessarily so. Does that make sense? And then you see this. You see in families where, you know, the great-grandfather is a, I'm thinking of a family where the great-grandfather on both sides was a businessman. And the grandfathers were business, you know, the great-grandfathers, the grandfathers, the fathers, and then, but only one of the sons. The other son's not. One son becomes a philosopher. I mean, this happened in, you know, my father ran a family business and then there was nobody to turn it over to. Now it's not in the family anymore. It was in the family generation. And then there was nobody who was interested and qualified. One son became a scientist, one, you know. So it's not always like that. We see in general, it's not always like that. The tendency is there, obviously. Maybe some inclination. Still, everybody has their own nature, and there may be a complex set of reasons why you take birth in a particular family. You might take birth in a particular family because, you know, you had some argument with them in the last life and you hated them. And you don't have their nature at all. So it's not a given. Now, in former times, we definitely don't know how to do this now, but in former times, they knew subtle sciences by which they could basically genetically engineer their children. We definitely do not know how to do this. But that's like the story of Parshuram, you know, where they knew how to say, okay, we're going to have a Brahmin child or a Kshatriya child. And it usually worked, unless somebody trained the wrong payasa. Well, we don't have to do that. We're not in touch with these subtle sciences. And it didn't always work. Like Maharaj Rishabdev, so some of his sons were Brahmanists, some of them were Kshatriya, some of them were Brahmins. You think about Dronacharya, his child acted like less than a Shudra. Even though Dronacharya was a Brahmin, even though he trained his son. He didn't even have the qualities of Kshatriya.